Coming up on Harvard Chan This Week in Health, getting to zero, a major milestone in the fight against the Ebola outbreak that has ravaged West Africa. Plus, what determines a successful response to a high-profile emergency? Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick shares leadership lessons from the Boston Marathon bombing. And we'll give you some extra incentive to cook dinner at home tonight. Hello, and welcome to Harvard Chan This Week in Health. I'm Amy Montemuro.
And I'm Noah Levitt. Amy, we begin this week with a major milestone in West Africa's two-year-old Ebola outbreak. The World Health Organization declared that Sierra Leone is now free of Ebola transmissions. The announcement comes after the country passed 42 days, equal to two incubation periods for the virus, without a new case.
Ebola hit Sierra Leone harder than any other country. Nearly 4,000 people were killed and 14,000 were infected. So far, the outbreak has killed more than 11,000 people worldwide. The next step for Sierra Leone is a 90-day period of enhanced surveillance. This period will allow health officials to quickly detect and respond to any new cases that may arise.
The announcement out of Sierra Leone leaves Guinea as the only nation where Ebola is still being transmitted. And Guinea is where the outbreak originated, and the New York Times reports that seven new cases have been reported in recent weeks. All are centered in a small village called Tana.
In a new poll this week, Americans are weighing in on e-cigarettes, which are rapidly growing in popularity.
Amy, the poll was a collaboration between Harvard Chan School and Stat News, and it found that 65% of Americans believe that e-cigarettes are harmful. Now, that's far less than the 96% surveyed who viewed tobacco cigarettes as harmful, but just slightly more than those who view marijuana as harmful. Those surveyed also weighed in on the issue of regulation, which is something both the FDA and Congress are currently grappling with.
And Noah, most Americans surveyed were in favor of regulation on e-cigs, similar to those currently in place for tobacco cigarettes. Those surveyed favored banning sales to minors and adding warning labels to packaging. We spoke to Robert Blendon, Richard L. Menschel Professor of Public Health and Professor of Health Policy and Political Analysis. He directed the poll and says that those views on regulation show that many Americans are comparing e-cigs to traditional cigarettes.
I think people are responding to a 60-year debate about what we should do with smoking and tobacco cigarettes in America and just feel they know enough that this is less serious but something like it, and just without waiting for science or anything else, just deciding, why don't we just treat this as something related to regular cigarettes. But I don't think they understand the science argument about, is this a way to wean people off who are currently smokers? And in Britain, the actual National Health Service is making a very big effort to get smokers to use this as an alternative.
We covered the debate over e-cigarettes in the summer edition of the Harvard Public Health magazine. You can read more by visiting hsph.me/e-cigs. Sometimes the response to a high-profile emergency, or even a surprise problem at work, has a successful outcome.
But other times, Amy, chaos and failure reigns. So what circumstances lead to a positive outcome or a negative one?
There are some important lessons to be learned by looking at the response to the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick shared his insights during a recent panel discussion at the Harvard Chan School. The former governor spoke alongside Lenny Marcus and Barry Dorn of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative at the Harvard Chan School. Former Governor Patrick says the tone of leadership was set just hours after the bombing.
I had had the experience in a previous life when I worked in the Clinton Justice Department and was in charge of an investigation of attacks on black churches and synagogues, which was at the time before 9/11 the largest criminal investigation in American history. And there were a number of agencies working on that that just could not get along. That experience is the reason why the night of the first day, we got all the law enforcement agencies together. And I said, look, everybody has a role, but one agency has to be in charge of the criminal investigation. Mm-hmm. That's not the whole of it, but the criminal investigation. And I said, I don't care who it is, but one of you has to be it. And in very short conversation, folks agreed it should be the FBI. And then I looked every agency head in the eye, and I said, are you agreed? Are you agreed? Are you agreed? And they all agreed. And it helped, mm-hmm. from the perspective of the of the criminal investigation.
Marcus and Doran say the response to the Marathon bombing was a classic example of swarm intelligence, the ability to coordinate response efforts without any one person being, quote, in charge, unquote. Marcus says it's defined by the five key principles all on display after the bombing.
One was unity of mission, save lives. And everyone in every one of our interviews, that was the first thing that people talked about. The second one was generosity of spirit and action. Everybody was ready to help. And we talked with people in the private sector. They were handing over the videos. We talked to people out at Target during the manhunt. Yeah. They were handing over cell phones. Okay. And all the way out to the community, we asked, you know, how are the people who are the tactical guys out there being taken care of? And nobody had sent them out food and water. Mm-hmm. And when they went from house to house, people made sure they had food and water. Mm-hmm. The third thing was everybody stayed in their own lanes. Everybody did their job and helped others succeed in theirs, whether it was law enforcement or the hospitals or the businesses. The fourth rule of swarm intelligence that we saw was no ego, no blame. Mm-hmm. Not to say that it was kumbaya. Mm-hmm. There were tense moments. However, for the most part, nobody was saying, I did it, and nobody was going around pointing fingers. And the fifth rule was a foundation of trusting relationships. Your team had been working together for many years together. They knew one another. Mm-hmm. And that tone which you had with your team then became the tone that went out to the other agencies that became involved, including the federal agencies, and all the way out to the community. And those five principles of swarm intelligence we found were extraordinarily helpful to the nature of the response and the quality of the response that you were able to lead.
Former Governor Patrick also praised Boston's hospitals for their response to the bombings, pointing out how they had practiced how to triage so that no one hospital would be overwhelmed. You can hear more about the discussion by visiting our website, hsph.me/DevalPatrick.
A rising number of American women are using long-acting forms of contraception. That's according to a new analysis of federal health data. According to NPR, more than 11% of women use an intrauterine device, also called an IUD, or a contraceptive implant to prevent pregnancy. By comparison, other methods such as birth control pills, female sterilization, and condom use all declined during the same period. Doctors say the rise in IUD and implant use can be attributed to their near 100% effectiveness, as well as their reliability. Implants prevent pregnancy for 3 years, while an IUD can prevent pregnancy for up to 12 years. Another important factor for patients, in plans established under the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies must cover all forms of birth control, including IUDs and implants. As always, check with your doctor or healthcare provider to determine which course of action is best for you.
A conference next week in Cambridge, Massachusetts will highlight the need for accurate identity management and verification systems. And the need is great. Nearly 2 billion adults lack an official ID, and 48 million children are unregistered at birth, with the highest numbers in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. Without ID, people can't get needed social services, get a license to drive, or participate in the political process. The free conference, hosted by the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights, will bring together experts to examine the scientific, technical, social, and political aspects of national ID systems. Visit hsph.me/NIDC to register for the National Identification Conference.
For the first time, the FDA is recommending a daily limit on the amount of sugar Americans consume each day. According to the proposed guidelines, we should limit added sugar to no more than 10% of our daily calories. For anyone older than 3, that means about 50 grams or 12.5 teaspoons a day. To put that in perspective, that's about the same amount of sugar found in one 12-ounce can of Coke. But soda isn't the only problem. Harvard Chan nutrition professor Frank Hu tells the New York Times that there's sugar hiding in many of the foods we eat, from ketchup to low-fat yogurt. That's why the FDA is also hoping to change nutrition labels on food. Currently, those labels only show the total amount of sugar, but the feds wanted to change labels so that consumers can distinguish between naturally occurring sugar and added sugar. Currently, sugar makes up about 13.5% of American diets, so public health experts believe that 10% goal is attainable.
This week, the nation is once again grappling with issues related to racism and discrimination.
The president of the University of Missouri resigned this week amid criticism over the school's response to a number of racially charged episodes.
And Noah, as this national debate continues, a conference at the Harvard Chan School will be taking a closer look at the experience of otherness. The week-long event, called Different Lenses, One Vision, or DLOVE, starts on Monday, November 16th.
And Amy, throughout the week, there will be open and collaborative discussion about the marginalization and struggles that different groups in the U.S. and abroad often face, and how those struggles can affect health. Speakers and panel discussions throughout the week will focus on a range of issues, from race and sexual identity to disabilities. The goal is to view the experiences of these groups through different lenses, with the hope of combating oppression and social isolation. We spoke to Morgan Shields, a Master of Science candidate at the Harvard Chan School and one of the event organizers. She hopes the conference will be a safe space where people can engage in an open dialogue.
Nobody is an expert on the lived experience of all people. I mean, it's just impossible. So really the point is to create a non-threatening environment that fosters open discussion so that everyone feels welcomed in that space, not just people who are already well studied on the topics. That's sort of a struggle that we have when it comes to diversity and inclusion, is how do we engage people who otherwise would not be here or who maybe are really interested but feel uncomfortable or feel that they don't know enough to be part of that dialogue. That's the opposite of what diversity and inclusion efforts should be doing.
To see the full event schedule and to RSVP, visit dlove-harvard.com. That's DLOV-Harvard.com.
And finally, this episode, another week, another question. Noah, how often do you cook dinner at home?
We usually try to cook at home at least 3 times a week, but I always eat breakfast at home, try to bring lunch a few days a week, so... Excellent. Trying to eat more homemade meals.
And that's a good thing, because a new study from the Harvard Chan School finds that eating homemade meals instead of dining out could lower a person's risk of type 2 diabetes. Researchers analyzed the lunch and dinner habits of 99,000 men and women over a 36-year period. They found that those who averaged 2 meals at home each day had a 13% lower diabetes risk than those who had fewer than 6 homemade meals each week.
And researchers say that eating at home is simply healthier than eating out, since restaurant meals are often high in processed ingredients and unhealthy fats. The study didn't provide a specific number of homemade meals people should eat each week, but the researchers generally say that more would be better, so I'm going to go home after this and cook some dinner.
Well, hey, and good for our nutrition as well as our wallets.
Exactly.
And that's all for this edition of Harvard Chan This Week in Health, a production of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health.
You can listen to this podcast anytime and stay up to date on the latest health news by visiting our website, hsph.harvard.edu, and check us out on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/harvardpublichealth.